Good afternoon and welcome to Outlook Live. I'm Jean Rourke with the Federal Reserve, and I'll be your facilitator. Today's topic is Keeping FinTech Fair, Thinking About Fair Lending and UDAP Risks. Our speakers today are Carol Evans and Katrina Blodgett. Before turning our call over to our presenters, let me run through the logistics with you on slide 2. All right. If you haven't done so yet, click on the webinar link you received after registering, or you can head over to our website at www.consumercomplianceoutlook.org. There, you can find the session materials and eventually the archive of the call. Just a quick note on the webinar, we encourage you to listen to the audio through your PC, but if you need a phone option, we do have a limited number available. As for questions, please submit them by clicking on the Ask Question button in the webinar player page. I'd also like to remind you that we're offering continual professional education credits for attending the session. If you're interested in that, you must do two things. First, you need to be registered for this session, and second, you must complete the post-session survey. And let me cover our legal language before turning our call over to our speakers. The opinions expressed in this presentation are intended for informational purposes and are not formal opinions of nor binding on the Board of Governors of the Federal Reserve System. All right, with all that out of the way, let's get started, and I'll turn our call over to Carol Evans, and I'll also turn it to slide 3.
Thank you, Jean. Good afternoon. I'm Carol Evans. I work in the Division of Consumer and Community Affairs at the Federal Reserve Board, where I oversee fair lending and UDAP enforcement. I'm joined by Katrina Blodgett, counsel in our Fair Lending Enforcement section. Katrina and I are both involved in analyzing fintech issues at the Fed. Thank you for joining us this afternoon. This presentation drew out an article published in Consumer Compliance Outlook, which is a Federal Reserve System publication dedicated to consumer compliance issues. The article is linked in the presentation, and you can subscribe to the newsletter as well as access the article on consumercomplianceoutlook.org. Further information, such as citations to studies and enforcement actions that we mentioned, may be found in the article. Our discussion today will focus on the benefits, opportunities, and risks of fintech. We'll provide a brief legal overview of fair lending and unfair or deceptive acts or practices, which is known as UDAP. We'll then discuss the importance of proactive consumer compliance. Finally, we'll focus on alternative data and provide some practical tips on questions to ask during the business development process. FinTech may provide enormous opportunities to consumers, including increasing responsible access to credit. We know that some stakeholders are worried that the complexities of consumer compliance laws, such as fair lending and UDAP, may slow down innovation. On the other hand, we appreciate that other stakeholders, including some consumer advocates, are worried that some firms are jumping into new data and products without adequately evaluating the risks. The concern is that some fintech trends may not only be unfair to certain consumers, but could exacerbate existing inequities in financial access and result in the digital equivalent of redlining. Our goal this afternoon is to offer some general guideposts to help leverage the promise of fintech while promoting a fair and transparent financial marketplace. Slide 4, please. FinTech is the use of technology to offer and deliver financial services. It's part of the continuing evolution of financial services. This presentation focuses on products and services offered to consumers and small businesses. FinTech offers many potential benefits for consumers and small businesses, as well as for financial institutions. Here are some notable benefits. Technology and big data can be used to make more efficient and accurate credit decisions for consumers and small businesses. This efficiency can increase speed and lower costs. Thus, FinTech could make smaller loans more profitable to offer and increase the supply of credit. FinTech also offers the potential to leverage more granular data about consumers' finances and small business operations to increase the accuracy of credit risk predictions. For example, bank account level data can provide information about cash flow to use in the underwriting process. FinTech has already offered consumers greater convenience with the ability to bank on their phones and promises much more. FinTech has also created new products to help consumers manage their financial lives, including campaigns promoting easy-to-use budgeting and savings tools. Jean, I'd like to turn it over to you for an audience polling question.
Okay, thanks so much for that, Carol. All right, everybody, grab your mouse. You should see a polling question pop up on your screen. I'll read the question for you and your options, and then I'll turn it back over to Carol. All right, the polling question reads, what type of alternative financial data do you see as having the most promise for lending decisions? And you have three options there. A is bank account inflows and outflows. B is rent payment data. Or C is utility payment data. So we will just pause for a few seconds so that all of our participants can respond to what they think the right response is. All right, and with that, I will stop that poll. And when I stop that poll, that box should disappear from your player page. And Carol, I'll turn it back over to you.
Thanks, Jean. And we'll review the answers to our polling question at the end of the presentation. Slide 5, please. Perhaps most intriguing, fintech may offer opportunities for the underserved. A Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection study found that about 26 million consumers are credit invisible, which means that they don't have traditional credit histories, and another almost 20 million don't have enough information in their credit files to generate a score. These consumers may be shut out of the credit system. FinTech offers the potential to responsibly underwrite and offer credit to consumers with little to no traditional credit history, leveraging alternative data, machine learning, artificial intelligence, and other innovations. Jean, I'm going to turn it back over to you for another audience polling question.
Okay, thanks so much for that, Carol. All right, let's pose that next audience question. You should see that box pop up on your screen. And I'm just going to dance around for a second to make sure it pops up for everyone. Okay, I see it on my screen. So let me read that aloud for you and then read your options as well. So the question is, what type of alternative non-financial data do you see as having the most promise for lending decisions? You have four options there. Educational data is the first option. The second is social media data. The third is online behavioral data, and online behavioral data such as the consumer's search queries or the websites they have visited. Or the fourth option is offline behavioral data, and that could be such as the merchants where the consumers has stopped and the purchases made at bricks and mortar locations. So a couple of options for you there. I'll just hang out for another couple of seconds to make sure that all of our participants are seeing that polling question and have enough time to respond there. And with that, Carol, I am actually going to go ahead and stop that poll. And that box, like I said, should close out for our participants. And I'm going to turn it back over to you.
Thanks, Jean. Slide 6, please. Along with the potential benefits of fintech, however, also come risks. As we will focus on in this presentation, fintech is not immune to the kind of consumer protection risks that face brick-and-mortar financial services. Some risks, such as redlining and steering, may be even more challenging for fintech than for traditional financial services, while other risks may be lower. Consumer protection risks that fintech innovations may face can include both fair lending and UDAP, which are the focus of this presentation. There are also other important consumer compliance considerations, such as the Fair Credit Reporting Act, privacy, and cybersecurity. Although we will not go into depth into these issues, they should be part of compliance planning for fintech products and services. I'm going to now turn over to Katrina for slide 7.
Thank you, Carol. I'm going to discuss the laws relating to fair lending and also to unfair and deceptive acts and practices. The Equal Credit Opportunity Act, which is sometimes referred to as ECOA, and the Fair Housing Act are the two key federal fair lending laws. Both laws apply to mortgage lending, and in addition to mortgage lending, the Equal Credit Opportunity Act applies to non-mortgage credit. On the consumer side, this includes things like auto lending, student lending, and unsecured small dollar lending. Equal Credit Opportunity Act also applies to commercial lending, like small business lending. An important facet of the Equal Credit Opportunity Act to understand is that it applies to any person who participates in a credit transaction, which can be multiple players for a credit transaction. That means that depending on the circumstances, both a fintech provider and a financial institution can be subject to the Equal Credit Opportunity Act for the same transaction. Like the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, the Fair Housing Act also has a broad scope. In addition to mortgage lending, it applies to many facets of housing transactions, including the sale or rental of homes or apartments, appraisals, and homeowners insurance. Because its coverage goes beyond just mortgage loans, it may apply to a broad array of fintech products. Slide 8, please. Both the Equal Credit Opportunity Act and the Fair Housing Act specify certain classes of individuals who are protected in covered transactions, commonly referred to as prohibited basis groups. Both laws protect consumers from discrimination on the basis of race, color, national origin, sex, and religion. In addition, the Equal Credit Opportunity Act prohibits credit discrimination on the basis of marital status, age, receipt of income from any public assistance program, or because a person has exercised certain legal rights under the Equal Credit Opportunity Act and other financial statutes. In addition to the shared bases of race, color, national origin, sex, and religion, the Fair Housing Act also prohibits discrimination on the basis of familial status and disability or handicap. Slide 9, please. The fair lending laws broadly prohibit two kinds of discrimination, disparate treatment and disparate impact. Disparate treatment occurs when a lender treats a consumer differently because of a protected characteristic. Disparate treatment ranges from overt discrimination to more subtle differences in treatment that can harm consumers and does not need to be motivated by prejudice or a conscious intent to discriminate. The Federal Reserve has made numerous referrals to the U.S. Department of Justice, or DOJ, involving disparate treatment and pricing where bank employees charged higher fees or interest rates on loans to minorities than to comparably qualified non-minority consumers. These cases typically involve situations in which bank employees had broad discretion to set interest rates and fees and could increase their own compensation by charging borrowers more. These referrals have resulted in several DOJ enforcement actions. Slide 10, please. Disparate impact occurs when a lender's policy or practice has a disproportionately negative impact on a prohibited basis, even though the lender may have no intent to discriminate and the practice appears neutral. Policies or practices that have a disparate impact may violate the law unless the policy or practice meets a legitimate business necessity that cannot reasonably be achieved by a means that has less impact on protected classes. Factors that may be relevant to a legitimate business necessity could include cost and profitability. As an example of a disparate impact matter, the Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection and DOJ brought a discrimination enforcement action against a wholesale lender in 2015. In that case, the Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection and DOJ alleged that the bank's broker fee policies and pricing practices resulted in minorities paying more for loans than non-minority borrowers. They also alleged that the policies that caused this result could not be justified by legitimate business necessity. In many cases, it's possible to frame an issue of possible discrimination as either disparate impact or disparate treatment. And in fact, many enforcement actions don't indicate which theory was used. In some instances, both theories may apply. So it's helpful to be familiar with both theories. Slide 11, please. Moving from fair lending to UDAP, there are several laws that may apply. Section 5 of the Federal Trade Commission Act prohibits unfair and deceptive acts and practices. The Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act also prohibits unfair and deceptive acts and practices, and also added a prohibition against abusive acts and practices. Many states also have their own UDAP laws with similar provisions. Deceptive acts or practices are representations, omissions, or practices that are likely to mislead a consumer acting reasonably under the circumstances and are material, which means that the deception is likely to affect the consumer's conduct or decision with respect to a product or service. Unfair acts or practices are those that cause or are likely to cause substantial injury to consumers that consumers cannot reasonably avoid. Additionally, the substantial injury must not be outweighed by countervailing benefits to consumers or competition. So let's look at how these can apply to financial firms. Slide 12, please. Deception in the financial services industry often involves misrepresenting the terms or costs of financial products or services. For example, in 2015, the Federal Reserve announced a public enforcement action against a provider of financial aid services to colleges and universities and account services to students receiving financial aid. The Federal Reserve alleged, among other things, that the company failed to disclose information about the fees, features, and limitations of the company's product before it required students to decide how to receive their financial aid disbursement. A recent matter is the FDIC's announcement in March of this year of an action against a company that offered debt settlement loans and services and partnered with an FDIC bank. The FDIC alleged that the company misrepresented the terms of its debt settlement loans and the extent to which it would negotiate debts with third parties on the consumer's behalf. The order requires that the law violations be corrected, restitution be provided to consumers, and imposes a civil penalty of nearly $500,000. Another example is an enforcement action by the FTC and the FDIC against a company that advertised credit cards to consumers with poor credit histories. The FTC alleged that the company violated the UDAP prohibition when it misrepresented the amount of credit that would be available to consumers when they received the card, failed to disclose upfront fees, failed to disclose that purchases that triggered the company's undisclosed risk algorithm could reduce a consumer's credit limit, and misrepresented a debt collection program as a credit card offer. Slide 13, please. The unfairness prohibition in the Federal Trade Commission Act also applies to financial services. In another FTC case, a website operator gathered a large amount of sensitive personal information from consumers for purported payday loan applications. Consumers believed that they were providing their personal information in order to apply for loans. But in fact, the FTC alleged, the website operator sold their application information, which included social security numbers and bank account information, to companies that fraudulently debited their bank accounts. The FTC's complaint alleged that this was an unfair practice that harmed consumers. I'll turn it back over to Carol for slide 14.
Thank you, Katrina. We'll now turn to consumer compliance. Proactive consumer compliance is critical when developing any new product or service and is especially important for fintech innovation. If I could give one piece of advice for listeners working in financial services, it would be to integrate consumer protection considerations into the early phases of business development. This means including compliance staff in discussions from the beginning. Once a product is already late in development, it's harder to go back in and add guardrails for consumer protection compliance. So, a better approach is to consider consumer compliance colleagues as key partners at each stage in the development of fintech products and services. In our presentation, we provide some general questions that can help guide thinking about consumer compliance risks early in the business development process when considering the use of new or alternative data. Keep in mind, though, that both fair lending and UDAP analyses are highly fact-specific
can vary in different scenarios. So these general questions are a place to start, but firms will need to work with their consumer compliance colleagues and counsel to fully evaluate these issues. Slide 15, please. Now I'd like to dive into big data. There's been a lot of excitement around big data, both positive and negative. For the purposes of our discussion today, we use the term big data to mean the analysis of large, complex data sets that are collected over time from different sources. These data sets, combined with developments in analytics, such as machine learning, can open up new approaches to data modeling. Instead of formulating a hypothesis and collecting data to test it, data sets can be analyzed to find patterns that may emerge. While there may be significant benefits from the availability and the use of big data, there also are potential concerns about fairness and accuracy. These concerns are not limited to financial services, but extend broadly to both commercial and governmental uses of big data. Here are some of the concerns. Predictions based on big data could result in bias towards some groups. Big data analyses may be used to restrict information flow for certain groups. And real or virtual communities may be excluded from opportunities. Media articles and reports during the past few years provide some examples of these issues. In the criminal justice system, a model used by courts to predict recidivism has been criticized for potentially over-predicting the chance that African-American defendants would commit another crime. On the web, researchers found that women were less likely to be shown ads for high-paying jobs. And when Amazon initially launched same-day delivery, its algorithms excluded many minority neighborhoods from the service. Jean, I'm going to turn back over to you for an audience polling question.
Okay, thank you so much, Carol. All right, I am going to launch our third polling question for the day. And just as that box pops up on your screen, I want to mention if your pop-up blocker is up or if you've set that pop-up blocker, you may not see the polling question. We did get a couple of people who said they weren't able to see those polling questions. I do have a lot of responses on our polling, though. So, Carol and Trina, I don't want you to worry. We've got lots of results to show you later. Okay, so the question is, for what lending product do you see the greatest promise in using alternative data? And your options are mortgage lending, auto lending, unsecured small dollar lending, or small business lending. All right, so I'm going to wait just a couple of seconds so you can respond. And I'll go ahead and stop that poll, and that box should clear from your player page. And Carol, I'll turn it back over to you.
Dean, please. So much depends on exactly which data are used and whether they are accurate, reliable, and representative of all consumers. One example outside of financial services that illustrates the importance of representing all consumers involves photo recognition software. Some software misclassifies images of African Americans and Asian Americans, presumably because the data used to develop the software did not include sufficient diversity. Data may also reflect past biases. If a hiring model for engineers, for example, is based on historical data, which may consist mostly of men, it may not adequately consider traits associated with successful engineers who are women. These illustrations show that while statistical models have the potential to increase consistency in decision-making and ensure that results are empirically sound, models also may reflect and perpetuate existing social inequities, depending on the data analyzed and the underlying assumptions. Thus, big data should not be viewed as monolithically good or bad, and we need to keep in mind that the fact that an algorithm is data-driven does not ensure that it is fair or objective. Jean, I'm going to turn it back over to you for another audience polling question.
Okay, Carol, thanks so much. And I believe this is our last polling question for today, so please grab your mouse and respond appropriately. I've posed the question, so that should pop up on your screen in just a moment. And I'll go ahead and read that question aloud. For what non-lending financial product do you see the greatest promise in using alternative data? And so the options are budgeting products, savings products, or investment products. And for investment products, that would be such as products that incorporate robo-advising. So I'll give you a couple of seconds to think about your response. All right. And with that, I'll go ahead and stop the poll. And by stopping that poll, that should clear from your webinar player page. And Carol, I'll turn it back over to you.
Great, thanks, Jean. Slide 17, please. I'd now like to turn to questions to ask early in the process when new data are considered. We'll go through each question in greater detail, but there are two main categories to consider. The first set of questions focuses on the basis for considering the data. We suggest asking whether the data have a nexus of creditworthiness, whether the data are accurate, reliable, and representative of all consumers, and whether the predictive power of the data will be stable over time. The next set of questions relates to how the data are being used. Are the data being used for the purpose for which they have been validated? Do consumers know how the data are being used? Are the data being used to determine what content consumers are shown? And which consumers are evaluated with the data? I'm now going to turn it back to Katrina for slide 18. Thanks, Carol. So we'll start with the first broad category of questions to consider, which is about selecting the data. Slide 19, please. When considering what type of data to use, start by asking if there's a nexus with creditworthiness. Some data have an obvious link to creditworthiness and are logical extensions of current underwriting practice, while others are less obvious. For example, for small business lending, some creditors are developing new underwriting models based on financial and business records. These models consider many of the same types of data used in traditional underwriting methods, but in an empirically derived way based on analyzing thousands of transactions. Some models may be expressly developed for certain businesses, such as dry cleaners or doctor's offices. In essence, these models are expanding automated underwriting, which has been used for mortgages and other consumer lending products for many years, to small business loans. Similarly, for consumer loans, some firms consider more detailed financial information from consumers' bank accounts to evaluate their creditworthiness, especially for thin-file consumers who may lack extensive traditional credit histories. Even with this type of traditional financial data, however, there are details to consider. The more speculative the nexus with creditworthiness, the higher the fair lending risk. For example, in evaluating bank account cash flow data, using this data to verify incomes and outflows will likely pose less fair lending risk than analyzing the contents of the data for behavioral signals. Slide 20, please. On the other hand, some data may not have an obvious nexus to creditworthiness. These types of data may be viewed as a proxy or a signal of potential creditworthiness or future income. Generally, the more speculative the nexus with creditworthiness, the higher the fair lending risk. And always remember, correlation does not demonstrate causation. Even if the data have some predictive foundation, to the extent the data are correlated with race or other prohibited bases under the fair lending laws, careful analysis is critical. For example, we understand that some lenders consider where an applicant went to school or an applicant's level of education. These data should be carefully evaluated for legal compliance before being used. The Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection staff took this approach in its recent no-action letter to a firm that considers educational data in underwriting and pricing loans, along with traditional factors such as income and credit score. The Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection recognized that this alternative data may benefit consumers who are credit invisible or lack sufficient credit history, and after carefully reviewing the company's proposal, issued a no-action letter stating that its staff had no present intent to recommend initiation of supervisory or enforcement action against the company with respect to the Equal Credit Opportunity Act. However, the Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection conditioned the no-action letter on extensive fair lending testing and data reporting. Slide 21, please. Careful analysis is particularly warranted when data may not only be correlated with race or national origin, but may also closely reflect the effects of historical discrimination, such as redlining and segregation. For example, it's been reported that some lenders consider whether a consumer's online social network includes people with poor credit histories. This practice can raise concerns about discrimination against those living in disadvantaged areas. Instead of expanding access to responsible credit, the use of data correlated with race or national origin can serve to entrench or even worsen existing inequities in financial access. Finally, it's important to consider that some data may not appear correlated with race or national origin when used alone, but may be highly correlated with prohibited characteristics when evaluated in conjunction with other fields. Slide 22, please. The next question to consider is whether the data are accurate, reliable, and representative of a broad range of consumers. Inaccurate data can inappropriately penalize consumers and impair their access to credit, and it also prevents banks from making loans available to creditworthy borrowers. In recent years, for example, concerns have been raised about the accuracy and reliability of medical debt data. Studies by the Federal Reserve and the FTC have found widespread errors in public record data on consumers' credit reports, much of which related to medical debt. Recent Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection complaint data have underscored continuing concerns from consumers about the accuracy of medical debt information. Complaint data shows that consumers are concerned that their credit reports may list medical debt that was already paid, was for the wrong amount, or was not properly verified. As a result of concerns regarding the accuracy of medical data, as well as concerns about its predictive utility, both FICO and VantageScore modified their scoring models to limit the weight placed on medical debts following 2015 agreements between the three largest consumer reporting agencies and the attorneys general of over 30 states. Slide 23, please. In addition to accuracy and reliability, it's important to consider whether the data are representative of all consumers or only a subset. Although the examples that Carol gave earlier in the presentation involving photo recognition of minority individuals and the hiring of female engineers may seem extreme, it's easy to see that many data sets may not be fully representative of the population for which the resulting model will be used. For example, data used for behavioral modeling, such as browsing and social media data, may be skewed towards certain populations. That said, while noting the risks, it's also worthwhile to pause and emphasize that new research on alternative data may in fact improve data ability and representation for the millions of consumers who are credit invisible. Lenders currently lack good tools to evaluate these consumers' creditworthiness, and alternative data may result in new data sources that are accurate, representative, and predictive. This kind of data can increase access to credit for this population and permit lenders to more effectively evaluate their creditworthiness. Slide 24, please. Finally, it's important to consider whether the predictive potential of the data is likely to be stable over time or ephemeral. For example, if a model uses online data from social media sites such as Yelp or Facebook, what happens to the reliability of those data as consumers' online habits evolve? I'll turn it back over to Carol for slide 25.
Thank you, Katrina. The next set of questions focuses on how you are using the data. Slide 26, please. We think it's helpful to start by asking whether the use you plan is one for which the data have been validated. Are the data being used for marketing, fraud detection, underwriting, pricing, or debt collection? Testing and
validating the data field for one use, such as fraud detection, does not mean it is also appropriate for another use, such as underwriting or pricing. Thus, it's important to ask if the data have been validated and tested for each proposed use. For lending, risk can arise in many aspects of a credit transaction. Depending on how the data are being used, it may be important to test for various fair lending risks, such as steering, redlining, or discrimination in underwriting or pricing. For example, certain data, such as geography, may be appropriate for marketing, but that doesn't mean the data are appropriate for underwriting or pricing. Slide 27, please. Another question to consider is whether consumers know how you are using the data. Although consumers generally understand how their financial behavior affects their traditional credit scores, alternative credit score models could raise questions of fairness and transparency. The Equal Credit Opportunity Act, as implemented by Regulation B, and the Fair Credit Reporting Act, require that consumers who are denied credit must be provided with adverse action notices specifying the top factors used to make that decision. The Fair Credit Reporting Act and its implementing regulations also require that consumers receive a risk-based pricing notice if they're provided credit on worse terms than others. These notices can help consumers understand how to improve their credit standing. However, particularly for alternative credit scoring systems that are developed with artificial intelligence or machine learning, consumers and even lenders may not know what specific information is used, how the data impact consumer scores, and what steps consumers might take to improve their alternative scores. It's therefore important that fintech firms and any banks with which they partner ensure the information conveyed in adverse action notices and risk-based pricing notices complies with the applicable legal requirements. Slide 28, please. Certain behavioral data may raise particular concerns about fairness and transparency. For example, in one FTC matter, the FTC alleged that the lender failed to disclose to consumers that their credit lines could be reduced based on a behavioral scoring model. The model penalized consumers for using their credit cards for certain types of transactions, such as paying for marriage counseling, therapy, or tire repair services. Similarly, commentators have reported to the FTC that some credit card companies have lowered consumers' credit limits based on the analysis of the payment history of other consumers that had shopped at the same stores. In addition to UDAS concerns, penalizing consumers based on shopping behavior or other data patterns that would be surprising to them may raise reputational risk. Slide 29, please. UDAS issues also could arise if a firm misrepresents how consumer data will be used. In an FTC action, it alleged that websites ask consumers for personal information under the pretense that the data would be used to match the consumers with lenders offering the best terms. Instead, the FTC claims that the firm simply sold the consumer's data. Using data in a way that is inconsistent with representations might violate the deception or unfairness prohibitions. Slide 30, please. The next question is whether you're using data about consumers to determine what content they are shown. This is a particularly complex issue. Targeting marketing offers both benefits and risks. On one hand, technology can make it easier to use data to target marketing and advertising to consumers most likely to be interested in specific products. This may make it easier and less expensive to reach consumers, including those who may be currently underserved. On the other hand, this targeted marketing may amplify redlining and steering risks by enabling firms to curate information for consumers based on detailed data about them, including habits, preferences, financial patterns, and where they live. Thus, without thoughtful monitoring, technology could result in minority consumers or consumers in minority neighborhoods being presented with different information and potentially even different offers of credit than other consumers. Slide 31, please. A DOJ and Bureau of Consumer Financial Protection enforcement action
illustrates the issues that can arise when a lender uses consumer characteristics to determine what offers they receive. In this action, a lender excludes consumers with a Spanish language preference from certain credit card promotions, even if the consumer met the promotion's qualifications. Several fintech and big data reports have highlighted these risks. Some risks relate to credit, and others illustrate broader risks in other areas. Here are some examples of these risks from recent reports. It was revealed that Facebook categorized its users in order to offer marketing segmentation by, among many other factors, racial affinities. A news organization was able to purchase an ad about housing and exclude minority racial affinities from its audience. This type of racial exclusion from housing advertisement violates the Fair Housing Act. In a different example related to credit, a bank used predictive analytics to determine what credit card offers, including subprime offers, to show a consumer. Another media investigation showed that consumers were offered different online prices for merchandise depending on where they lived. The pricing algorithm appeared to be correlated with distance from a rival store's physical location, but this resulted in consumers in areas with lower average incomes seeing higher prices for the same product. Likewise, a media investigation found that an SAT prep course's geographic pricing scheme meant that Asian Americans were almost twice as likely to be offered a higher price. As a final example, a study at Northeastern University found digital steering or price discrimination at 19 out of 16 retailers. This resulted in consumers seeing different products or different prices on the same product. The core concern here is that, rather than increasing access to credit, these sophisticated marketing efforts could exacerbate existing inequities in access to financial services. Thus, these efforts should be carefully reviewed. Some well-established best practices to mitigate steering risk could help. For example, lenders can ensure that when a consumer applies for credit, he or she is offered the best terms she qualifies for, regardless of the marketing channel used. Slide 32, please. The last question that we suggest is to consider which consumers are evaluated with the data. In particular, are algorithms using non-traditional data applied to all consumers or only those who lack conventional credit histories? Alternative data fields may offer the potential to expand access to credit to traditionally underserved consumers, but it's possible that some consumers could be negatively impacted. For example, while some have urged the reporting of utility payment data to help consumers build a credit history, some consumer advocates have expressed concern that the use of utility payment data could unfairly penalize low-income consumers and undermine state consumer protection. Particularly in cold weather states, some low-income consumers may fall behind on their utility bills in winter months when costs are highest and catch up during lower-cost months. One potential solution to consider may be applying alternative algorithms only to those consumers who would otherwise be denied based on traditional criteria. This approach could help ensure that the alternative data sources expand access to credit. While such second-chance algorithms still must comply with fair lending under laws, they may raise fewer concerns about unfairly penalizing consumers than algorithms that are applied to all applicants. We understand that FICO used this approach in its FICO XP score, which relies on data from sources other than the three largest credit bureaus. This alternative score is applied only to consumers who do not have enough information in their credit file to generate a traditional FICO score. Finally, your approach of applying alternative algorithms only to consumers who would otherwise be denied may receive positive consideration under the Community Reinvestment Act. Recent interagency Community Reinvestment Act guidance includes the use of alternative credit histories as an example of an innovative or flexible lending practice. Specifically, the guidance addresses using alternative credit histories, such as utility or rent payments, to evaluate lower moderate income individuals who would otherwise be denied credit under the institution's traditional underwriting standards due to a lack of conventional credit history. Slide 33, please.
In conclusion, fintech can bring socially beneficial innovation to consumers, including benefits such as convenience and speed. It also makes BIN responsible and fair access to credit. Yet, fintech innovation faces the same consumer protection risks faced by more traditional financial services. Some fintech trends could potentially amplify certain risks, such as redlining and steering, while other trends may mitigate certain risks, such as inconsistent decisions. While fast-paced innovation and experimentation may be standard operating procedure in the tech world, when it comes to consumer financial services, the stakes are high for the long-term financial health of consumers. Thus, it's up to all of us, regulators, enforcement agencies, industry, and advocates, to ensure that fintech trends and products promote a fair and transparent financial marketplace, and that the potential benefits are realized and shared by as many consumers as possible. Thank you so much for listening this afternoon. And while we're waiting for your questions to come in, we'll turn it back over to Jean for the results of our polling questions.
Okay, thanks so much for that, Carol. All right, let's take a peek at the polling results. We'll go back to question number one, which was about the type of alternative financial data and what was promising for lending decisions. And I'll let you know that of the three responses, 68% of our participants said it was bank account inflows and outflows, 22% said rent payment data, and 10% said utility payment data. So that was interesting. Okay, so that box did pop up for everyone. Oh, all right, good. I'm going to stop the results there, and I will show the results for the second question. So I'm just hanging out for just a second to see if that pops up. Okay, it's up on my screen. And this was the alternative non-financial data and what was most promising for lending decisions. And it looks like the highest percentage of our participants, which was at 42%, said offline behavioral data. And then 27% said educational data, 23% said online behavioral data, and then 8% said social media data. All right, very cool. And now let's go to the third one, show those results for the group. So I'm going to just pause for a second while I watch the box pop up on my view. Okay, it's there. So this question was about the lending products that see the greatest promise in using alternative data. And the highest percentage of responses was the third response, and that was 48% of people said it was unsecured small dollar lending. And then the second was 26% of people said it was mortgage lending. And then the two last responses were very close. 14% said it was small business lending, and 13% said auto lending. So that is very interesting. And I'll stop displaying those results. Okay, and I will show the results of the last question. All right, wait for a second for that to pop up. Okay, it's up on my screen. And this was about non-lending financial products and what was the greatest promise in using alternative data. And so it looks like 40% of participants said it was investment products, a close 37% said budgeting products, and 23% of our participants said it was savings products. So I will stop showing the results of that last polling question, and then I will turn it back over to Carol and Trina in the room.
Thank you so much, Jean. We're starting to get questions, and we really appreciate them. One questioner asked if the CFPB's no action letter referenced in slide 20 is available to the public, and if yes, could we provide the details to locate a copy? Katrina, could you answer that question?
Absolutely, and that's a great question. Yes, all of the enforcement matters that we mentioned are public, including the CFPB's no action letter on the use of educational data. The companion article to this presentation, which is linked to your webinar announcement and in slide three, has citations to all of the enforcement actions, the no action letter, and all of the studies and media reports that we mentioned today. So you can find a link for that no action letter in the article. You could also Google CFPB no action, and you can get the results that way through a search, but this is public.
Thanks, Katrina. Another question was, what kind of due diligence should a bank do before partnering with a fintech firm? Could you take that one as well?
Yeah, and this is another really good question. This is an important topic, and unfortunately, a whole discussion is beyond the scope of our presentation today, but I will mention a few basic points. Banks have a stake in ensuring that their vendors and third-party service providers act appropriately. They have a stake in seeing that consumers are protected and treated fairly, and that the bank's reputation is not exposed to unnecessary risk. So managing those third-party relationships is critical. The Federal Reserve has vendor management guidance in CA Letter 13-21, and the OCC and the FDIC also have vendor management guidance. So, as with any new business activity, it's important for a bank to ensure that its use of big data, alternative scoring, or other new fintech innovations fit within its risk appetite, and that the bank is well positioned to understand and manage those risks. Ultimately, board and senior management are responsible for all aspects of a bank's operations, whether performed by a bank employee or a third party. So as I said, this is a complex area, and it may be helpful for banks to discuss any questions that they have with their examiners. Carol, did you have anything to add to that?
Sure. I would just note that Consumer Compliance Outlook provides multiple articles on managing third-party relationships. And I think those are available on the Outlook Live page. And there's also an Outlook Live on vendor risk management. And it may be also just to step back here for a minute and emphasize that we view fintech, including bank fintech partnerships, through our supervisory missions of safety and soundness and consumer protection. Within that framework, we do have an interest in encouraging socially beneficial and financially sound innovations to flourish while ensuring that consumers are protected. Many facets of fintech can help promote a fair and transparent marketplace, so we don't want to unnecessarily restrict innovations that can benefit consumers or small businesses through expanded access to financial services, efficiency, convenience, and reduced transaction costs. Another question is, can we talk more about consumer risks of machine learning? I can take that one. This is a great question. Machine learning can offer significant benefits, such as the ability to test many variables and models in very little time, and the ability to almost continually update models. So machine learning may facilitate the development of new models that can help underwrite some thin file consumers who can't be scored and who otherwise would not qualify for credit. But the same traits that make machine learning so powerful can also make the models less transparent and highly fluid. So this lack of transparency and the fluidity can make compliance more challenging. So, for example, in a machine-developed model, the decision-making criteria and the factors might be harder to identify, and that can make the scoring much more opaque, and this can make compliance with the adverse action provisions of the Fair Credit Reporting Act and the Equal Credit Opportunity Act more complicated. Additionally, if consumers don't know what factors are important, they can't improve their credit scores. And the potential for this lack of transparency and fluidity could also make compliance with the Fair Lending Laws and UDAP provisions of the FTC Act more challenging. And this is in contrast to more traditional credit scores that are based on more static models and typically rely on well-established credit history factors such as payment history, credit inquiries, length of credit history, debt burden, and the like. Katrina, do you want to add anything about some of the benefits that you alluded to earlier?
Yeah, thanks, Carol. I'll also add that the use of machine learning shows potential to leverage the type of financial data that I mentioned earlier. AI and machine learning can make it easier to analyze more granular data about consumers' financial habits and small businesses' operations, and this can be used to increase the accuracy of credit risk predictions. So right now, commercial underwriting often has to be tailored to individual circumstances and done on a case-by-case basis, and this can get really expensive. If new analytic methods could leverage, for instance, daily cash flow data from a small business to to spot trends and determine the appropriate risk level for lending, that automation could allow for more accurate risk predictions for underwriting and bring the cost of underwriting that loan to a level that makes small business loans more profitable. And that kind of AI or machine learning that facilitates cash flow analysis could also be applied to consumers' bank account data. So this could be beneficial, for example, for evaluating consumers in the gig economy whose hours may vary week to week, but nevertheless have stable income.
Thank you, Katrina. That's really helpful. The next question is, how much fair lending testing is needed before using new data for lending decisions? I can take a stab at this one. This is a really important and a highly fact-dependent question. There needs to be sufficient testing that you're comfortable that you're complying with the fair lending laws. Generally, the stronger the nexus data factor and creditworthiness, the lower the fair lending risk. And, of course, the level of fair lending risk will affect how much testing is needed. So, for example, as Katrina mentioned earlier in the presentation, using data from consumers' bank accounts to assess income or debt-to-income, that poses less fair lending risk than using that account data to analyze, say, where consumers shop or analyzing for other behavioral data. But at the end of the day, this is a highly fact-specific analysis, and it will require consultation with legal and compliance staff. The next question is, would you examine a bank's use of fake data in a fair lending examination? Katrina, could you take this one?
Yes, thanks, Carol. And this is another really good question. So we view fintech as potentially raising the same types of fair lending risks as are present in traditional banking, including underwriting discrimination risk, pricing discrimination risk, redlining risk, and steering risk. So in fair lending reviews by Federal Reserve examiners, the use of big data may arise in several ways. First, as part of a product review, we may consider underwriting and pricing criteria, whether those are based on traditional data or on non-traditional data. And second, we may look at the use of big data in marketing. In our exams, we generally look at marketing, and this is especially meaningful in a redlining analysis of mortgage products. So we would review that marketing to determine whether we would review that marketing, whether it's based on big data or on more traditional marketing factors and channels. And we really appreciate how engaged the audience has been in asking these great questions. We've received a number of questions that we did not get a chance to answer today. However, we are reading them carefully to look for themes to include in future articles or presentations. So I'm going to turn it back over to Jean for some final remarks and information. And Carol and I thank you so much for your attention today.
Okay, thanks, Katrina, and thank you, Carol. I am pushing out a survey link for today's session. We'll also be sending you an email with the link to the survey. You really only need to fill it out once, but please do let us know how we're doing. We read every response and strive to make our sessions better based on your feedback. And I'd like to thank our presenters, Carol and Katrina, and the Outlook Live team for their time. As a quick reminder, remember to check our website, www.consumercomplianceoutlook.org, for the archive of this call and for information on upcoming sessions. Thanks for joining us. This concludes today's Outlook Live webinar. Enjoy the rest of your day.